Amen. Well, good morning. We've been studying through the book of Judges, and it's really an interesting, fascinating time in the history of Israel. If you've been with us, you recall that the children of Israel would fall into idolatry, really mess things up. God would allow somebody to conquer them. They would then cry out to God. God would raise up a hero to deliver them. And then they would get complacent, fall back into idolatry, just cycles over and over again. And at least up to this point, you have intermittent times of some heroic action in the middle of some devastating failure as well. So now as we've come to towards the end of the book, the last five chapters, we'll look at chapter 17 and 18 this morning. We get to the point where there are no more deliverers, no more heroes. Nothing good is happening anymore in Israel. And we see kind of what caused them to completely plummet to the ground, to completely fall apart and to fail as a people. And although we're not going to see any good news here, nothing positive, no heroes, we do understand how people can become corrupted, how ministry can become corrupted as well, as the influence of money and power bring down that which God intends to be a blessing and to draw people closer to Him. During this time in their history, you may recall, as the children of Israel brought the tabernacle over from the wilderness where they had it, and they brought it to a place called Shiloh that was up a little bit north of Jerusalem. And it was there that the children of Israel were to come and worship God regularly. There were 12 tribes of Israel, and 11 of them, including the two half-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, were given certain plots of land. But one of the tribes, Levi, they were supposed to be the ministers. They were the ones who would help everyone draw closer to God, be involved in worship. And so the Levites were supposed to be spread out throughout the kingdom, and each tribe would give the Levites a special area. And then these Levites were supported basically by their taxes so that then they could do the work of ministry. But we see how far they had fallen from that as we read this story in Judges chapter 17, and it just goes from bad to worse. The chapter starts, chapter 17, in the mountains of Ephraim, which is an area just a little bit above Jerusalem, up there above Bethlehem, the central part of, you know, what would today be called the West Bank. And the mountains of Ephraim, and there was a guy named Micah. Now, Micah is no hero. He's no judge. He doesn't ever really do anything very honorable that I can see. People argue whether he should be considered a judge or not, but he certainly wasn't. And when we drop into his story here, his mom had 1,100 shekels of silver stolen from her. 1,100 shekels of silver was quite a bit of silver. A shekel was about half an ounce of silver by today's valuation of silver, or, you know, it's close to $19 an ounce. That would be $10,500 in silver. But for them, silver was way more valuable because 90 shekels of silver was 1 year's wage for a laborer. So if you translate that into what this would, 1,100 shekels would be 12 years of minimum wage labor, which would come in our dollars to like $375,000. So this was a pretty sizable chunk of money, of silver, that had been stolen from Micah's mom. Well, it turns out Micah was the guy who stole the silver from his mom. But his mom had said, "I'm putting a curse on whoever stole this silver." Kind of superstitious to think you could put a curse on people anyway, except curses work only as well as you believe them. And so they all believed it, and Micah's like, no, I don't want the curse. So he comes to his mom, and he goes, you know that silver? I don't want to be cursed, so here. And he gives it back to his mom. And she's like, I was going to give that to you anyway. So she said, what I wanted to do, and as you read down in verse 3 of chapter 17, he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to Yahweh, to the Lord, for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. And so he gave the silver to his mom, and his mom took another 200 shekels of silver, gave it to a silversmith, and made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. And verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Just go, okay, Junior, you're a priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. See how far they've come? That this woman is calling out to Yahweh, to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and yet what she wants to do is use money to make idols for God. It was an amalgamation of, you know, pagan superstition interwoven with Judaism, and she thought nothing of it. And so he takes this and he sets up. Now, they weren't that far from Shiloh, where they should have been going to worship God in Shiloh. But this was just more convenient. It was like, hey, I can make my own little shrine right here, which lets you know that he thought of the tabernacle in Shiloh as just being another shrine. So he thought, why not make his own? You know, worship is going downhill when people don't want to be inconvenienced in the slightest way. I've talked before. I always think it's funny when, like, one time I was in Costco and a lady came up, oh, Pastor Dave, we love your teaching, listen to you all the time. And then she goes, we used to go to your church, but we moved. And I go, oh, where did you move? And she goes, Irvine. Well, yeah, that would have been a huge sacrifice. I understand that. But that's kind of what Micah's up. Yeah, it's a ways away. Let's just do it. We can make our own magic right here. And so, you know, as you read on through the story, the next thing that happens is there were some people from the tribe of Dan. And, well, first of all, he was happy with his little shrine, but then he hears this guy coming through who came to his house, and this guy had an accent that he recognized as a Levite. So he talks to the Levite, and he says, hey, you should just live here and be my personal Levite for my little shrine to Yahweh. And the Levite, who should have been serving God, you know, God's people by serving God and all, he gets this offer. And down in, verse 10, here's the pitch. Micah said to this Levite, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. This isn't a great offer. Like, you can live with me, I'll take care of you, and I'll pay you 10 shekels a year. That's like nothing. A minimum wage worker would get more than that. Although, to be fair, if he's also giving him everything he needs to live on, it's room and board and whatever else he needs and clothes, and then also I'll throw you another 10 shekels for you to do, you know, God knows what with. Maybe it sounded like a good deal to a Levite who didn't have a place to stay. It reminds me, though, of like Pastor Gene Scott years ago, the guy who was on TV, is really crazy, but he lived like a king. He had mansions and racehorses and strippers and everything, but he was, you know, he had a salary of $1 a year with an unlimited expense account. So maybe that's sort of what this guy's, the deal he was getting. But it says the Levite in verse 11 was content to dwell with the man. He's like, this is a good deal. And so he became like one of Micah's sons until he got a better offer. But Micah consecrated the Levite. The young man became his priest, lived in his house. And verse 13, Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. And then the beginning of verse 1 of chapter 18. In those days, there was no king in Israel. So what a mess. It's deteriorated so far that this guy is designing his own worship of God, and then he hires a Levite who should have been serving God, but instead now, no, he is working for Micah. And he's like happy to do it. What could possibly go wrong? But as you read on in chapter 18, there were these people from the tribe of Dan. And the tribe of Dan, one of the tribes of Israel, they had a plot of land that they were supposed to conquer, but they had never actually done it. Where their land was supposed to be was in a more of a coastal area, and it would be a little more challenging to do it. So they were just thinking, there's other places. Let's go find a place where we can settle down and retreat. And so the Danites had sent out 5 spies who were mighty people, and they were heading up toward the northern part of Israel. And they came upon Micah's house, and they stayed there. And as they were there, they said, it said in verse 3 that they recognized the voice of the young Levite. So he either sounded like a preacher, he was like regular guy in the house, but he's like, well, God said that, you know. So they're like, huh. Or maybe Levites had a different accent, I don't know. But they ask him to give them good luck. They said to him in verse 5 of chapter 18, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous. They weren't really asking. I mean, they were just wanting him to bless them, and he figured it out. He goes, go in peace, the presence of the Lord be with you on your way. He didn't pray, didn't seek God or anything. He just said, bless you, my child. You know, God's with you. That's a pretty safe thing to say to anybody. God's with you, since God's everywhere. But they went on out and they headed up to this city called Laish, up in the far north of Israel. It is a beautiful country up there. Where the city of Dan ended up being established, where Laish used to be. When we go to Israel, we go up there, and it's one of my favorite places. It's the headwaters of the Jordan River come out of there, and it's forested and water rushing through. It's really a beautiful, amazing place. So they came up there and found this group of people, this city of total, you know, peace freaks. Like, these people had no army or anything. They were just like, we're just living and loving. You know, they were just kind of loaded and enjoying themselves. They had this great city. And so they're like, we can conquer these hippies easily. And so they head back down and they get their armies, the armies of Dan, which all they needed was a few hundred people to go with them. So they came back and said, look, you're going to see a secure people, a large land. This is verse 10. God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that's on the earth. So they got 600 soldiers, and they were going to head up there and conquer Laish and establish Dan there. On the way, as they came across Micah's house, where the rent-a-priest was, they were, you know, like, oh, yeah, these guys are really nice. And there's a Levite in here. And they go, and by the way, this guy has like all kinds of idols and fancy stuff that he's developed. And the spies told their armies, they go, we're not telling you what to do. I'm just saying there's some valuable stuff in there. And so naturally they go in and they thought, you know, this is nice. So they were going to take the stuff. And as they were taking the stuff down in verse 18, the priest said to them, what are you doing? And they said to him, be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, Micah, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? So they just said, they made him a better offer. They're like, he hired you? Come on. No amount of money is going to be as valuable as the kind of power and influence you will have being the priest over a whole tribe of Israel, the tribe of Dan. And so the priest said, no, I'm loyal. This guy's like a father to me. No, he said, the priest's heart was glad. And then he gathered up all the idols and images himself and took off with them. as you read on in the story, you find that Micah realized, hey, his priest was gone, and he chased after them, and he came up and they said, what's the problem? And he said, verse 24, you have taken away my gods, which I made. What an ironic statement. I made my gods and you have taken them away. How do you expect me to get by without my man-made gods? And you took my priest and you've gone away. What more do I have? How can you say to me, what ails you? And the children of Dan, the armies, just said, look, you're going to make us mad. An angry man will come on you and kill you. You have any more questions? And Micah's like, I guess I can get by with, you know, that priest, it was costing me. And so he just goes back. They carry all these idols up to Dan. They conquer the city of Laish, establish the city of Dan, which today is Tel Dan. There's a big excavation that's there in that city. They set things up, and then they took all those carved images and they established a religion up there. Now, the city of Dan is quite a ways from Shiloh, but it says they set up those carved images and they had other priests and they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. Now, northern Israel had their own worship center, and ultimately this Levite had a chance to become more influential than just being a household priest for Micah. And it's like, wow, that's pretty depressing. That's pretty weird. What a mess Israel had become. And usually in the book of Judges, you would start thinking, and then God raised up a Gideon or a Barak or Jephthah or Samson or, you know, Deborah, somebody. Nope. God's just like, okay, fine, I'm done with you. You really want to worship idols? Have at it. And they deteriorated, and then we'll see in the last three chapters next week, this pathetic, it's a story that's ugly, I'll warn you. It's disgusting. How far they deteriorated before they really basically destroyed themselves to a huge degree until God came along later and touched a little boy named Samuel, and finally there was again some hope, and later raised up King David and so on. But at this point, it's spiraling from here on. Now again, with all the other stories in Judges, there's always been like, well, that was cool. They turned from idolatry for a while. It was brutal. You know, you had Samson, kind of a sleazy guy, but ultimately killed a bunch of Philistines, so that's good. You know, you have a story of a woman driving a tent stake through the bad guy's head, and you're like, well, that's kind of good, but it's kind of weird too, and there must have been a better way to deal with it. But you're going through all of this. Now we get to these chapters, and there's like nothing redeeming in here. And yet, God put it in the Bible. There's something that we are supposed to learn from this passage and from this era in history. And so we're left to figure out, so what's the point of this story, okay? You got a family who's messed up. They use their money to go into idolatry. They hire a Levite, and then that guy gets taken by somebody else, and he goes for the more influential, more powerful job, and then they just set up a center of worship of paganism, and what do we learn from it? Well, a few things that I will at least suggest to you. First of all, on a very basic, fundamental level, you cannot just make up your own religion. You can't just decide to say, I'll include God in my religion. I will do, you know, there are aspects of all different faith systems that have something to offer. I'm going to design my own. Ultimately, that's how weird cults and stuff start. You know, whether it's like Scientology, where L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer, and he said, one of the greatest scams in the world is to invent your own religion. And then he did, and it continues. And he just made up all kinds of stories about spaceships and everything else and incorporated it into it. Every cult has usually some core of truth somewhere. And then they just make up a bunch of stuff to go with it. It doesn't work that way. You don't find God by designing your own belief system. Ultimately, as they said here over and over again, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. What that is there was no objective authority, so whatever you think and feel is just as good as what someone else thinks or feels. Sounds a lot like today in a whole lot of ways, where even in the name of democracy, if you let people vote, but they all agree that there is a standard for what's right, like a constitution or something, you know, then you have some basis of authority. But if you take away all bases of authority and now you give everyone a vote, it's a pooling of ignorance completely. It's like some home Bible studies where, you know, go around the circle and go, how many disciples are there? And somebody goes, I think 14, and somebody else says 8, and somebody says 6. You average it out. There's 7.5 disciples. There's no authority to say, this is real, this is what we trust in. It's simply, I am creating my own system that I feel comfortable with. And I think people do this a lot. It's like there are preachers today who basically just eliminate the Old Testament because they're not comfortable with some of the things that God did back then, and they think that Old Testament God was kind of a cranky God and New Testament God, Jesus, is just all loving and accepting, but they also cut out the book of Revelation because cranky God shows up again. But it's like it's an easy way to do religion, just take what you want and eliminate everything else. But it doesn't connect you to God at all. Authority is stripped away, and you design nothing. You become a fool, ultimately. The old rock band Depeche Mode had a song called Your Own Personal Jesus. Johnny Cash actually recorded it right before he died. He did a great job of the song, but Johnny didn't understand the song at all. What the song was about is, you can take anything and turn it into your own Jesus. They were actually inspired by the relationship of Priscilla Presley with Elvis Presley and the way that she just shut her whole life down and from the age of 15 just worshiped Elvis. And so the song was kind of poking fun at what people do is they design their own, this is my own Jesus. And today you hear, and even Christians who would listen to Johnny Cash singing this, it's like, oh yes, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Jesus is real. God is real. He is not your own personal God. He is not your own personal Jesus. In fact, a lot of what you do, he doesn't like. Sorry to let you in on the clue. You either align yourself with him, or you're automatically aligning yourself away from him. Remember when Joshua, before he was going to march around Jericho, as God had told him, he met an angel of the Lord standing there with a big sword, and he was this huge, massive angel. And Joshua said to him, are you on our side or are you on their side? And the angel of the Lord said, neither. I have my own side. I don't take sides. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Ultimately, when you design your own religion, it always leads to idolatry. It always leads to adding elements that are inferior to whatever a relationship with God really is. Because worshiping God is fairly simple. It's not complicated. But when you design your own religion, you're adding in traditions and elements, and whether it's a liturgical bells and smells stuff, or whether it's a, you know, kind of a hippie interweave politics with your religion, or, you know, hardcore right wing, whatever. It's like, no, faith in God is about God. It's not about you figuring out your own take on who God is. God doesn't want to join you and become a part of your agenda. People are constantly adapting a particular system and then turning it into a Christian version of that system. A lot of people have made a lot of money, for instance, taking the study of psychology or psychiatry, which are legitimate fields, but then they just go put a few verses next to it, and it's the same, except that it's like this is a Christian version of it. You have to be careful when you do that. It's We need to stick with who God is and what he says, and it's still okay. Just like there are people who have Christian diet and exercise programs. Diet and exercise programs are great, but you don't have to act like, oh, this is the one from Daniel, or this is the one from Genesis, or this is the, you know, diet of Joseph, or you know, it's like, no, just don't eat and exercise because it'll make you live longer and you won't be so fat. But you don't have to somehow spiritualize it and act like God is disgusted by your belly. It's like, no, he's not. That's not his thing. That can totally be your thing. Just don't make it a Christian thing. It's just a human thing. And we are always in jeopardy when we start to clutter our worship of God in with some other pitch that we may get attracted to. And there are Christians who are really into Christian meditation. Christian meditation is a real thing that the Bible teaches about, and it's valuable, I believe. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who just take Buddhist, you know, meditation, which the Buddhists adopted from the Hindus, and then just sort of put a Christian spin on it in some way. And they do the same with yoga and everything else. Like, no, just keep your faith simple. Know that you're connected to God because of his word and what he says, and you don't need to keep, you know, inventing other stuff to be a part of your faith. It's like setting up, oh, I got my Levite, and we are worshiping Yahweh, and we're doing it with these idols. It's clear God doesn't appreciate that kind of stuff. But you also see in this passage what happens when a person who is supposed to be a minister, the Levites were there to minister to the spiritual needs of the people, but when a minister becomes a hireling, it's really a problem because we are all capable of being corrupted by finances, by what pays. And so it's one of the problems that we have really in our culture where the government, there's such a separation of church and state that you'd never get away with what the Jews had where taxes paid the ministers. And we're a long ways away from that. So people who are ministering have to get paid somehow, but there's a point to where I'm doing this because of the money. I'm doing this simply as a way to gain. What happens? Levites compromise when their dollars are at stake. And so they'll justify things they shouldn't. They'll say things that they want. And they won't say things that, you know, you realize, oh, I could say that, but oh man, it'll cost us. Our offerings will go down. We've got to keep the message and the messenger as pure as we possibly can. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. In churches, there are several different ways that churches can be governed. Because, you know, originally churches were a handful of people meeting in a house, didn't take a lot of structure. But as churches have become bigger, it's more complicated. So there is a form of church government called an episcopal church government that is basically the heads of the denomination make all the decisions that flow down to the local church. Then there's a Presbyterian form of church government that says the elders rule. The elders are the ones who are in charge. The pastor works for the elders. Then, you know, there's a uniquely American form of church government called congregational government, which is like we all get a vote. And the church I grew up in as a kid was congregational, and I used to love the church congregational meetings because they would argue about everything, and it was so entertaining as a kid. You know, sometimes I'd be whispering things into adults' ears just to get them to complain about certain things. But the trouble with all of those forms of government is the person who's supposed to be telling you the truth is afraid to offend the denomination. They're afraid to offend the elders. They're afraid to offend the congregation. And the problem with that is the job of a minister is to offend you. If nothing that I say ever offends you, I have failed you. All I'm doing is telling you what you already think. And so when it comes to ministry, it's so important to not be bought off. Now, at the same time, there's a lot of money that gets involved with ministry, and there are things that people can do for the sake of ministry, but it all ends up corrupting you, and it feels like you're catering to whoever gives the money. I've mentioned before that sometimes I'll have somebody who wants to meet with me in my office, and they mention, as they set the appointment up, you know, I tithe to this church and I have a right to talk. Anybody can talk to me. You don't have to tithe. You don't have to go to this church. I'll talk to anybody. But whenever they say that, I always look up and just ask my secretary, how much do these people actually give? And I've never had somebody who said that ever give more than $50. And so I did one time. I just, you know, the guy dropped that on me. I tithe to this church. And I go, you want your $50 back? And that was over 3 years. And he was like, oh, he looked pale as a sheet. And, you know, we lost a member. Cost us $50. But, you know, that's how it works when control is like that. Now, the alternative, Calvary chapels tend to usually be pastor-led. I fully understand the danger of that. When you have one person who is, you know, the minister, the leader of the church, there are a lot of abuses that can happen from that as well. But I've seen so many churches destroyed by all the other forms of government. It may be that for the pastor to answer to the Lord might be the best of a lot of bad solutions anyway. But this story lets you know. I hope you don't think that you've hired me as your pastor, because you should have fired me a long time ago if you could. But I'm trying to be faithful. Money can turn ministry into business. It's not supposed to be that way. But as you come to chapter 18, even more corrupting than money when it comes to ministry is power and influence. Ministry shouldn't be traded for power. If, in fact, this Levite felt like he was doing what God wanted him to do in Micah's house, then why was he so willing to jump to a next opportunity to, well, I'll be even more important now? And believe me, power, I mean, money is intoxicating for sure, but power is much more intoxicating than money. If you don't believe me, ask yourself, why do billionaires want to be president? Lots of them. Because obviously, money is not their God. Ultimately, they would rather have their influence and their power even than huge chunks of their money that they're willing to trade for it. But when it comes to ministry, we need to be aware of that. And this is something that just brings me to tears often as I think and pray about it, is because when you're serving God so often, you do realize people think about, you know, what you think, and they listen to you, and it's humbling when you see people who, yesterday was at a wedding down in San Diego, and a few people came up and just go, I feel like I'm meeting a celebrity. You're like, listen to your podcast all the time, man. We met one time when we were over in China, and it's just like, that's nuts, man. I don't even really want my own family to look up to me that way, and they don't. But my church, there's something that just feels hard about that and wrong about it. At the same time, you appreciate, I hope I helped somebody. And people are always, you know, telling, oh, you shouldn't be so self-deprecating. But it's very intentional, because I can't fool myself into thinking that if I start feeling I'm very influential, that that might not hurt me, that that might not destroy me. See, when you want money or power, that determines what you think is what you pitch. But the job of ministry is to tell people what's right. It is not to get a feel for what everyone thinks and then go, well, we should do that. So we don't vote on everything. You hear sometimes enough and you go, well, this is kind of weird. I mean, like today, for a while in our worship, during when Jerry's praying and doing the announcements, the keyboard player would play notes. And I always thought, sounds kind of weird, but I didn't say anything about it. Well, a few people complained about it last service. I'm sure they got together on it. And so we were talking about it backstage, and I go, well, let's try it without, you know. And I didn't really just say, look, I think these codgers that complained are totally correct. But, you know, but I said, I've thought that myself. I get it. But if we did that on everything that we do, let's check the wind. What is it that people want? Yes, we might have more people. We might have more influence. We might have more money. But who would we be ultimately when the job of ministry is to tell people what they don't want to hear? The job of ministry is to establish a standard for what's right and wrong, irrespective of people's opinions, and often contrary to it. We end up losing who we are if we compromise for money, power, or influence. Power turns money, ministry ultimately, into just a means to an end, and it's a way to control people. If I say this, people will do this. That's not how it works. That's not how God does things ever. As a church, we really try to stay away from fundraising, and we try to stay away from politics. Not because either one of those is wrong. Our radio production people are always going, Dave, if you just put a little commercial in the middle of your program, I'm telling you, those really work. Write a few books, sell them, get donations for different stuff, and I'm telling you, your whole radio program could be paid for easily. And I'm like, yeah, I hear, but, and I told them, I go, honestly, the reason I don't do that is because I know how I feel when I hear everyone else doing that. It just feels cheap. And I'm afraid if I gave a commercial, I would do it sarcastically and it would be counterproductive anyway. I just don't want to do that. For the same reason, I'm not up here harping on politics. I understand some people feel like that's their ministry. I don't. I look at the mess that our country is in, and I don't think it's a clear this or that thing. But even if it didn't, I look at it like, I don't want to be a Levite that goes, let's go for the power. Boy, if I was in Washington, I could do this, or if I could gain control, or I control votes. For one thing, and if I really wanted to be involved in politics, I would leave California immediately. You know, the People's Republic of California, where your vote, if you're a conservative, doesn't mean anything anyhow. But the reason I don't harp on that is like half, at least half of the people who I want them to know that Jesus loves them, I want them to know that God understands them and cares about them, half of those people will be pushed away if I start harping, you know, if I start being super progressive or super conservative or whatever, doesn't matter. My agenda is higher than that. It just, our church is not about money and it's not about power. And so we try to avoid it. Please forgive me when you think, boy, you should say something about that debate or you should say something about that impeachment or whatever. No, that's not what we do. There's plenty of other people who can talk about that stuff. We try to maintain a focus on what God has called us to do. And that's just what we do. Sorry. If you're like, no, I really want to hear somebody comment politically, or I really want to hear somebody who's pushing more for money, trust me, there's a bunch of churches where you'll be totally comfortable. They always say about ministers that what's going to bring them down is money, power, or sex. Here we have money and power in these two chapters. Next chapter we'll see a Levite with a concubine, which kind of covers the other one. But the really weird thing today is that when ministers are obsessed with money and fame, we like worship them. We encourage that. Those will corrupt you. Ultimately, if you're corrupted financially and politically, the sex thing is just a natural outflowing of that because you feel like you're entitled. You need that. You desire that. You want it. But here in these chapters at the end of Judges, it's like, wow, it's really very similar to today where we sell out the things that matter most for things that ultimately don't matter at all. But, you know, I'm not just going to talk about Levites and ministers because the fact is for every one of us, we decide, what does integrity look like for me? How do I make the choices that I make? How do I choose to live my life? And money is a blessing, and so is influence, but they're really bad guidance systems. And if we are living our lives in such a way that money is always dictating what we're going to do, or what other people think, power and influence is dictating what we're going to do, as Jesus said, what will it profit a person if they gain the whole world and they lose their soul? Every one of us has to decide, what do I really believe? What are my core beliefs? What is it that at the very basis of what's valuable and important to me? And the way to live your life is to minimize the things that aren't worthy of that place in your life. Ultimately, what is it that you won't compromise? Compromising morally is a horrible failure. But before you compromise morally, you've probably already compromised financially and in terms of power and authority and influence. It's a natural flow that happens. And every one of us has to live with who we are at the end of the day when we look at ourselves in the mirror and just say, what do you really stand for? Where are your core values? What does integrity look like for you? Integrity, I love the word because it means you're a whole number. You're not fractioned. You're not split. You're like, well, on the one hand, I'm going to be doing this, but on the other hand, I want to do that. Integrity is, I know who I am. I know who God is. I want to do what he wants, and I don't care what it costs me. I don't care what it costs me financially, and I don't care how it affects the way that people see me. Ultimately, I have to live with myself and my God at the end of the day. That's what ultimately happened to Israel here. That's what brings the period of the judges completely to a crash and burn close. And you'll see, in fact, you might want to skip next week because it's gross. It's really an awful story. It's another one of those stories you'll never hear about in Sunday school about a, well, you'll hear next week. But who are you? And how do you choose to live? This is something that speaks to those who are in ministry, but this speaks to all of us. What does integrity look like for me and for you? And answering that question and then choosing to live by it is what mental health looks like. Somebody who is living consistently with who they are, refusing to believe delusions, refusing to do things in order to accomplish other things, just living simply as God has made you, with principles that guide you through every aspect of your life, whether it's your professional life, your family life, your social life, whatever it is, living by a higher calling and a higher standard. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for these examples throughout the book of Judges of how many amazing things you can do through people who are really messed up. But at the same time, what happens when integrity is completely traded away for trinkets and souvenirs, or for being thought of in a certain way, or power and influence? Help us, each of us, by your Spirit, to discover what's really important to us at the core, and to not trade our soul away for garbage. Lord, if there's anyone here today who's never committed their life to you, who's never experienced what it feels like to be clean and forgiven, to be loved by the God of the universe, I pray that you would be drawing them even now to realize there's so much more to life than the labor and the heartbreak and the tragedy that they've experienced so far. Please draw them, let them know their life can start over today. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand.